This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present To Rule the Waves, How the British Navy Shaped the Modern World by Arthur Herman. Narrated by John Curlis. Introduction. The job of the historian isn't just to recount or explain the past, but to show how things have come to be what they are. This book will show how a single institution, the British Navy, built the modern global system, which is our system, for better or worse. It did this first by challenging and toppling the global system forged by Spain and Portugal in the age of Columbus. Then it reshaped the world in the 18th and 19th centuries to fit the needs and desires of the British Empire. Those needs, access to markets, freedom of trade across international boundaries, an orderly state system that prefers peace to war, speedy communication and travel across open seas and skies, remain the principal features of globalization today. Of course, a complicated historical development on this scale demands far more players and factors than just the British Navy. But take it out of the picture, and the history of globalization becomes murkier, more haphazard, less inevitable and certain. Without it, a British Empire would have been unthinkable, and without a British Empire and its successor, the Commonwealth, half the world's independent nations wouldn't exist today. Other nations might have built a modern unified world, but they probably wouldn't have done it as quickly, efficiently, elegantly, or as humanely. In fact, not since the Roman legions has an ostensibly military force had so decisive an impact on the history of its own nation and the world. An American, Captain Alfred Mahan, was the first to assert that the history of Western civilization has been the history of sea power, the ability of states and empires to exert control over the wide common of the oceans and deny it to others. Through sea power, even a small nation could dominate its neighbours by controlling their access to resources while securing its own, and even a small nation could bend events, trends, geography, the globe itself, to its will. This is the essence of what it means to rule the waves. In the 16th century, a handful of Elizabethan adventurers from Devon and Cornwall, John Hawkins, Francis Drake, Richard Grenville, Walter Raleigh, grasped these principles and used them to challenge the dominant world system of the day, which Spain and Portugal had built to exploit their empires in Asia and the New World. They inspired their fellow Englishmen to believe they would one day replace Spain and Portugal as rulers of the world and rule an empire that would be aggressively English, militantly Protestant, and rely on control of the seas instead of phalanxes of standing armies. It was to achieve that end that John Hawkins remade the Royal Navy into the prototype of a modern sea force. The men of the 16th century still saw an English empire as a reflection of their own personal glory. Hawkins in the Caribbean, Drake in Panama, Martin Frobisher in the ice-bound reaches of Newfoundland, were all seekers after their own fortunes, as well as servants of their nation and queen. But at the moment of crisis, in 1588, they were able to come together to thwart the master of the global status quo, Philip II of Spain, and his invincible armada. The failure of the armada signalled the doom of the old system. After 6 decades of crisis and uncertainty, the elements for a new one finally arose from the ranks of the Royal Navy that Hawkins had created and his successors nearly ruined. In the 17th century, the Navy and sea power became irrevocable parts of the English national identity. The Navy became the key to victory in the English Civil War, 1642-48, and a key player on the world stage in the years of the Commonwealth and Oliver Cromwell's protectorate. The restoration of monarchy in 1660 proved that no political power or faction, not even the king himself, could dare to challenge the navy's dominance over England's life and institutions. The wars the Royal Navy fought against France in the 18th century only deepened the lessons of sea power. The navy made England's trade boom and prosper. It sustained its colonies and reshaped its politics. It drew England, Scotland, and Ireland together into a single united kingdom. It enabled Great Britain to avoid prolonged land wars on the continent, yet break the power of France, Europe's most powerful state. Thanks to its control of the seas, Britain was poised by the beginning of the 19th century to create its own global imperial system. It would be unlike any other in history. While Britain itself maintained a polity based on limited government and the rule of law, its empire increasingly relied on trade rather than dominion, and cooperation with rather than conquest of other sovereign states. All this was made possible by its navy. Sea power made sure that the nation's wealth depended on an active and expanding middle class. It removed the need for large standing armies, and hence large intrusive government. It established safe and secure trade routes, stretching from America and the Caribbean around the coast of Africa to India and China. It was this sea-going world system that Napoleon had to break in order to make himself absolute master of Europe. It was the Royal Navy, led by men like Horatio Nelson, that stopped him in his tracks and preserved the liberty of Europe and the rest of the world. The world system that emerged after 1815 would be one increasingly reliant on the Royal Navy as international policeman. The sea routes on which the British Empire depended were made accessible to other nations as an expression of the British principle of free trade. The peace and security the Navy brought to Britain's shores increasingly extended to other parts of the world. The personal liberty Englishmen enjoyed became a basic human right, as the Navy wiped out the slave trade. British Navy vessels regularly intervened to protect Britain and non-Britain alike from tyranny and violence. An empire originally born out of ruthless ambition and brutality had become the basis for a new progressive world order. That order would survive the convulsions of the 20th century and the downfall of the British Empire itself. Britain passed its essential elements on to its successor, the United States, and its navy. A Pax Americana would succeed the Pax Britannica. The reflection of American sea power and its ability to keep the world's sea lanes open. Even with the advent of new forms of warfare, such as air power and ballistic missiles, the sea remains the cornerstone of today's global system. Almost 95% of trade that crosses international boundaries is waterborne, as is 99.5% of the weight of all transcontinental trade. Today, the British Navy may be only a shadow of its former self, but its legacy remains as powerful and relevant today as it was in the age of Nelson. The modern students of British sea power, from Alfred Mahan to Paul Kennedy and Nicholas Roger, have all recognised the crucial link between the Royal Navy and Britain's national destiny. Likewise, historians of the British Empire have pointed out how that empire formed the essential features of our contemporary world order. Just how those two histories relate to each other and why is what the reader discovers here. This is the story of how a navy forged a nation, then an empire, and then our world. Chapter 1. Incident at San Juan de Ulua. Anonymous ballad. A seaman hath a valiant heart and bears a noble mind. He scorneth once to shrink or start for any stormy wind. For 3 days, the ships had struggled to hold their own against the hurricane. The wind out of the southeast had howled through the masts and rigging, tearing at their battered sails and smashing waves across their decks. There were 5 of them, sailing blind into the storm in hour after hour of blackness. All they knew was that they were somewhere west of Cuba, and that they had to keep their ships pointed into the wind, or else they could end up being thrown onto the coast of Spanish Florida. Their only guide through the perpetual darkness was the wildly tossing stern lantern of the Jesus, the flagship of their leader and commander, John Hawkins. Storm-tossed ships, 5 tiny fly specks in the midst of an empty hostile sea and in the heart of a hostile empire. Yet, without knowing it, they were about to alter history. A crucial moment had arrived in the struggle for global power. A new antagonist was about to enter the fray, England. John Hawkins' experiences over the next 12 days in September 1568 would mark the start of a century-long struggle with Spain for dominion over the New World, and also the start of the modern British Navy. No one would have been more surprised by this than John Hawkins. 35 years old, small and spare, he wasn't a visionary, but a man of action, a tough, experienced mariner, and the kind of man others naturally followed, even into a 3-day hurricane. He'd spent every moment of those 3 days on deck. Rain streamed from his hair and beard as he ordered men aloft to take in sail so that the hurricane wind didn't snap off a weakened mast or spar like a matchstick. At one desperate point, he had even been forced to cut away the top section of his mainmast to reduce the strain. The Jesus was an old ship, a leaky tub with sprung timbers and a rotten hull. Now, after days of battering, she was ready to give way completely. The carpenter came up from below and bellowed in his ear that the timbers around the stern post were about to burst. The gaps between them were so wide that fish were able to swim through into the hold, the carpenter said. If those timbers opened any wider, they would founder and sink. Why were ships invariably referred to as women? Because words for watercraft in Greek, Latin, Italian, and Spanish are almost all grammatically feminine. For example, nave, which made English translators of books on navigation render the pronoun form as she. This was John Hawkins's 3rd trip into the Caribbean. His father, William Hawkins of Plymouth, was the first English merchant to gatecrash the trade monopoly Portugal and Spain enjoyed with their colonies in the New World. William Hawkins had made a fortune running goods from the Guinea coast, the 2,000 miles of African coastline from the Senegal River to the mouth of the Niger, to Portuguese Brazil. His sons, William and John, had joined him on those dangerous transatlantic voyages when they were barely teenagers. But unlike his father, John Hawkins wanted more than just the occasional smuggling raid. He envisioned a regular trading network from Africa to America, with English ships offering the one commodity of which Spanish settlers couldn't get enough, slaves. Slavery was a fact of life in the 16th century. The African slave trade was already the largest form of commerce in the world. No one had the least qualms about it, least of all Africa's own tribal rulers. It was also vital for running Spain's empire in America. Hawkins figured he could offer Spanish settlers slaves in greater quantities and at a lower price than they could get from their own merchants. Then they would pay him with a product from the New World everyone craved, but which Spanish law forbade to all outsiders: gold and silver from the mines of Peru and Mexico. Once the trade got going, the Spanish colonies would flourish, England would prosper, and Hawkins would be a rich man. the uncrowned king of the New World. In 1562, Hawkins sought permission for his first slaving voyage from Queen Elizabeth. "The voyage, I pretend," he wrote, "is to load Negroes in Guinea and sell them in the West Indies in truck of gold, pearls, and emeralds." He got her tacit approval, as well as backing of a large syndicate of London merchants. In October, he set out from Plymouth for Tenerife, the central island of the Canaries and gateway to Africa and America. After stopping several Portuguese slave ships off Guinea and buying or hijacking their cargo, it's unclear which, Hawkins made his way across the Atlantic to Hispaniola, the island where Christopher Columbus had landed 70 years earlier, and which was now a thriving Spanish colony. Hawkins did a brisk business with the local planters. They liked being able to buy their black labour at a fraction of the official price of 100 ducats per head. Hawkins returned triumphantly home in August of 1563, in ships laden with gold, silver, pearls, sugar and hides. So much sugar and hides, in fact, that he had to hire 2 extra ships to carry it all. Everyone was happy, except, of course, the slaves, although Hawkins took better care of his expensive cargo, even outfitting them with shirts and shoes, than did slavers in later centuries, and the Spanish authorities, who had just seen their monopoly broken and their laws flouted. Hawkins had done everything to try to accommodate and placate them, even though the Spanish were Catholics and Hawkins a God-fearing Protestant. He appealed to the traditional alliance between England and Spain. He pointed out how the trade would benefit Spaniards, not just the English and himself. He had even shipped some of his goods on to Seville, so that he could pay customs, just like any regular Spanish merchant. Instead, the authorities seized the lot and threw Hawkins's men in prison. But in the end, Hawkins's position was clear. Law or no law, he was going to do business in the Spanish Caribbean. He had something to sell, and his customers were more than willing to buy. If King Philip II's officials in Spain and America didn't like that, then they would have to find a way to stop him. Hawkins's first voyage had been so successful that his second voyage in 1564 attracted some of the most important names in the kingdom as investors. The Queen's favourite, Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester, her first minister, William Cecil, William Herbert, Earl of Pembroke. The Queen staked her own claim by contributing one of Her Majesty's own navy ships, the Jesus of Lübeck, an impressive, high-prowed and high-sterned vessel of 700 tons, with 64 guns of varying sizes and a crew of 80. Her father, Henry VIII, had bought it from German merchants, and assessors estimated it was worth £2,000. Only later did Hawkins discover how clumsy, leaking and unseaworthy the old Jesus really was, and how Elizabeth had gotten into his deal on the cheap. Even in the teeth of opposition from King Philip's government in Madrid, which sternly ordered that no one do business with that brigand and outlaw, Capitán Aquines, Hawkins's second voyage was even more successful than his first. He returned to England on September the 20th, 1565, with all his slaves sold and all 5 of his ships intact, having lost only 20 men out of 200 to drowning or disease, and returning for his delighted investors more than 60% profit. But now, as he tossed helplessly in the hurricane-force winds off the Florida coast almost 3 years later, Hawkins must have wondered if his luck had run out. It was as if this third voyage to the New World had been cursed from the beginning. First, the 2 Portuguese pilots who were supposed to guide him further down the African coast disappeared while he was taking on supplies in London. Then, on July 30th, just as they were preparing to leave for Plymouth and the final outfitting, a piece of heavy gear broke loose from the Jesus and killed a woman bystander. When the Jesus and his four other vessels did reach Plymouth, Hawkins had an unpleasant run-in with a squadron of ships from Spanish Flanders. Their Flemish commander refused to dip his colours, as all foreign ships were required to do when they passed English Navy ships in the Channel, and Hawkins had been forced to fire a shot across their bows to get him to comply. The same commander then had the audacity to ask to berth his ships alongside Hawkins in Plymouth Harbour. The Flemish ships were passing England on their way to meet King Philip to take him on a tour of his Netherlands possessions, their commander said. But Hawkins doubted it. He suspected the Flemish were there to spy on him and wanted to get close enough to learn what kind of cargo Hawkins was taking on and where he was going. Hawkins refused them any berths in Plymouth, and so the Flemish sailed on. Hawkins's bad luck continued as he came out of the Channel. He ran into four straight days of bad weather north of Finisterre, the westernmost tip of Brittany. Storms opened a seam in the Jesus's hull so wide that they had to shove 15 sheets of thick baize cloth into the gap to keep her from sinking. On reaching the Canary Islands, he had an argument with one of his men who drew his sword and cut a gash in Hawkins's forehead, narrowly missing his eye. The days when an English sailor didn't dare to challenge his captain on pain of death were still far in the future. Worst of all, when they finally reached Africa and the Guinea coast, they couldn't find any slaves. Every time the English landed to try to round up captives, the alert natives either fought them off or disappeared by running into the jungle. Hawkins lost 7 men to poison dart wounds. Another 2 drowned when their small boat was rammed by hippopotamus. Finally, in desperation, Hawkins had to strike a deal with 2 of the local chieftains to help them besiege the town of one of their enemies and split the prisoners between them. The result was a grotesque horror, even by Elizabethan standards. For 2 days they besieged the great compound of grass huts with its wooden stockade, while Hawkins lost 9 more men dead and 20 wounded. Then, fed up with the desultory pace, Hawkins led his men in a full frontal assault, smashing holes in the stockade with cannon brought on shore, and rushing through the gaps with torches tied to their pikes and halberds to set the town alight. His African allies followed behind, but instead of helping to round up captives, they began a systematic massacre of men, women, and children. The terrified inhabitants fled the flames and the attackers. Thousands leaped into the river and adjoining swamps and were drowned or trampled to death. All night, the fires continued to burn, until the screams of the dying and drowning finally died away. In a horrible finale, their African allies cut up and roasted the bodies of their enemies to consume them in cannibal ritual while the wounded and exhausted English were forced to watch. The next morning came the final insult. Amid the smouldering ruins, Hawkins was left with only 400 prisoners instead of twice that number as he had been promised. But since that was the same number of slaves he had brought away on the previous voyage, and after the horrors of the previous night, he and his men were happy to get off the coast and away from Africa at last. Once he arrived at the Spanish Main, the Caribbean coast of South America, he found local officials were more uncooperative than ever. Sales in Barbareta went well, but at Rio Acha, Hawkins had to use cannon to intimidate the local governor into allowing him to set up an impromptu slave market on the beach, with English sailors roughly shoving their captives into line while Spanish settlers looked over their prospective purchases, before stepping up to haggle and bargain under the blazing sun. Then came Santa Marta, and finally Cartagena, where, as Hawkins wrote later, the governor was so straight that the English were not even allowed to land take on food and water. He was only 2 days out of Cartagena, short on supplies, but with a hold full of gold and silver when the storm struck. Now, after 3 days of constant battling to keep his leaking flagship from sinking, Hawkins reached a hard decision. He would give up trying to fight the storm and would run with it, all the way back past Florida and into the Gulf of Mexico if necessary, in order to save his ships, as well as the bullion they were carrying. Hawkins ordered his men to hang out 3 lanterns, the signal for the others to bear away from the wind and run with it. Then the Jesus's prow swung awkwardly as Hawkins tacked around to the south. One by one, the others followed. The Minion, 300 tons and commanded by John Hampton, was an even older ship than the Jesus, with the same high fore and aft castles. But the Minion was a seaworthy and seasoned veteran of Guinea coast voyages. Like the Jesus, she carried a full complement of guns. Then, moving with more ease, came the Swallow of 100 tons and the Angel of 30, followed by the Grace of God. She was Hawkins's latest acquisition and named by him. She wasn't English at all, but Portuguese built, a fast-running bark with 8 guns and a French captain, whom Hawkins met when he was plying the African coast, and who had decided to cast his lot with the enterprising Englishman. The last was the Judith of 50 tons, commanded by a squat and exuberant 22-year-old skilled beyond his years, who also happened to be Hawkins's distant cousin. His name was Francis Drake. In the surrounding storm and gloom, one ship missed the signal. Instead of bearing away, Captain Thomas Bolton and Master James Rance kept their ship pointed into the wind, keeping station, as a mariner would say. The rest of the fleet bucketed along behind the Jesus and disappeared without noticing they had left one of their own behind. The next 2 days and nights, the wind hurled them along the coast. Lashing wind in the rigging and braces had changed from a moan to a shriek, telling them that the hurricane was finally losing its force. The next day, the rain stopped, and the wind suddenly shifted from the southeast to the north. Instead of the warm, humid gales they had been fighting for almost a week, this wind felt cold, almost icy, as the sky once again began to grow black. Hawkins realized what was coming. The first of the winter season's northerly storms was about to hit his little fleet broadside. All he could do was once again reef, or shorten the amount of sail exposed to the wind, and brace himself for the next onslaught. It came with less violence than the first storm, but lasted almost as long. Timbers creaked and groaned, masts swayed and strained, and below decks, barrels and guns pulled at their secure lashings with each pitch of the ship. The smaller ships, the Judith and the Angel, threatened to tip over or broach in the howling blast, which was pushing them deeper into the Gulf of Mexico. Day after day, the Jesus's carpenters watched the bursting seams in her stern with alarm as water poured in, while exhausted men cranked away at the pump to spew it out and overboard. Finally, on September the 11th, the storm blew itself out. The last clouds scudded past to the southwest. Hawkins and his men were in a part of the Gulf of Mexico none of them had seen before, off the southwest corner of Yucatan, and they were running low on food and water. They rode the freshening breeze all night, and the next morning spotted 2 small sails on the horizon. Hawkins ordered 2 fast-oared boats, pinnaces, out after them, catching one whose Spanish captain told Hawkins that the only port ahead on their course was San Juan de Ulua, 15 miles south of the capital at Veracruz. It was 4 days sailing. He also told Hawkins something else. San Juan was where the annual Spanish treasure fleet from Seville picked up the bullion from the mines of Mexico, and the fleet was expected that month. If they arrived before the Jesus did, that would mean that the harbour would be swarming with well-armed Spanish galleons. However, after checking once more below decks, Hawkins realized he had no choice. It was San Juan or sink. He ordered his helmsman to set course for the Mexican coast. As night fell, the new watch came on deck, and the hourglass marking the time was turned. Everyone on board the Jesus assembled around the mainmast. There they knelt and bared their heads as the quartermaster began evening prayers. It was part of daily routine on Hawkins's ships, as one of his crewmen later remembered, and everyone would recite the Psalms of David, Our Father, and the Creed in the English tongue. Afterwards, Hawkins would offer his standard admonition. Serve God daily, love one another, preserve your victuals, beware of fire, and keep good company, meaning keep close together for safety's sake. On September the 15th, Hawkins's lookout spotted land, and before nightfall, the little fleet dropped anchor in sight of San Juan de Ulua. The place hardly deserved being called a harbour. It was a shingle of sand, separated from the barren mainland by a deep inlet 400 yards wide. Barely a quarter mile long and no wider than 200 yards, a bow shot across, as Hawkins put it, the island rose only 3 feet above high tide. A few small huts housed its Spanish garrison and some black labourers. Otherwise, there was nothing, either on the island or the mainland. But it was the only safe deep harbour along the entire coast. Massive iron rings sunk in the sand kept ships safely moored, and even the strongest storms and gales left ships in San Juan Inlet undisturbed. This was why the Spanish treasure fleet chose to load its gold and silver there, instead of north at Veracruz. And above the island, far beyond the beach and surrounding jungle, and visible from many miles at sea, rose the great volcanic peak of Orizaba, its snow-covered peaks silhouetted against the fading September sun. Hawkins could make out ships in the inlet, but he couldn't tell how many or what kind. That night, he no doubt consulted with his other captains, including Drake, and resolved on a plan. They would enter San Juan the next morning. However, they would show no English flags or other identification. Only the battered royal standard with the Queen's coat of arms would fly high from the top of the mainmast of the Jesus and from the foretop of the Minion. The three Spanish vessels they had seized on their way to San Juan would accompany them as added protection and camouflage. By the time the San Juan garrison realized who he was, Hawkins hoped, it would be too late and his ships would already be in harbor. The morning of the 16th of September found Hawkins and his ships cautiously making their way toward their uncertain rendezvous. Hawkins had no idea what to expect. However, he had ordered men armed with crossbows onto the sturdy platforms or fighting tops of the masts, and had his guns cleared for action. For all the problems below decks, the Jesus cut an impressive figure above the waterline. The ship carried a towering forecastle in the bow and a massive aft castle over the stern, which were both built to withstand waves of boarding parties or bombardment by the heaviest guns afloat. The aft castle alone had 4 separate gun decks, each equipped with the various iron and bronze artillery pieces of the age. In addition, the ship was fitted with 2 14-foot bronze culverins and 9 even heavier cannons, each of which could hurl a 25-pound ball into the hull of an enemy vessel with devastating effect. Unfortunately, all this armament and defensive timber also made a Tudor-era warship, like the Jesus, top-heavy and unstable, as the captain of another ship, the Mary Rose, found out one day in 1545, when too sharp a turn drove water into his open gunport and carried him to the bottom of Portsmouth Harbour. Now Hawkins watched intently as the Jesus slowly glided into San Juan. His men were poised on deck, with their crossbows and pikes lying beside them, or were at their guns below, matches smouldering and ready to fire. The only sound was Hawkins' commands to his helmsman, who was one deck below him, gripping the long rod or whipstaff that turned the rudder at the stern. The ship's wheel wouldn't be invented for another century and a half. Hawkins could make out 12 ships moored in the harbour, including a once-proud ocean-going carrack of 700 tons, but now stripped of its masts and left as a hulk at the inner side of the inlet. Then, as the Jesus came around the southwest corner of the island, he noticed another feature of the harbour, gun batteries pointing out to sea, including one, its Spanish crew standing at the ready, trained directly at him. The entire harbour filled with an explosive crash as all 5 Spanish guns opened fire on the Jesus, and great plumes of smoke billowed out across the water. Hawkins was about to give the command to return fire when he realised it was a volley fire, not in anger, but in salute. The Spanish assumed that he and his ships were part of the treasure floater, arriving to drop off cargo and supplies and await the bullion. Hawkins's deception had worked better than he thought. He had to take advantage of it before they realized their mistake. It wasn't until the Jesus had dropped her anchors and crewmen had secured the bowline on shore that the Spanish looked up and noticed that the faded blue and red banner flying from its mast wasn't that of Spain, but England. At once the cry went out, "The Lutherans are here!" The place flew into a panic. Men abandoned their posts, labourers their tools, and soldiers their weapons. They leapt into any boat or craft they could find and began madly rowing for the shore. Some even ran into the water and began swimming for it. In a few minutes, the beach was empty, while Hawkins' men quickly deployed and secured the island. A single forlorn figure remained. It was the garrison commander, Captain Antonio Delgadillo. He had managed to keep his nerve while his men deserted him, although his position could hardly be called encouraging. Hawkins sent his second in command, Robert Barrett, to talk to him. Barrett was Drake's cousin and fluent in Spanish and Portuguese. He explained to Delgadillo, they were the Queen of England's ships come in there for victuals, and that Hawkins intended no harm. He needed time to refit and repair. He would pay for anything he used. All he asked was the permission and cooperation of the officials of San Juan. Delgadillo was in no position to argue. All morning he had watched the ships come in, believing that they were the treasure fleet from Seville. He had even prepared a little 5-gun salute to welcome the distinguished guest the fleet would be conveying to Mexico, Don Martin Enriquez de Almanza, the new viceroy of New Spain. Instead, it turned out to be that dreaded English outlaw Juan Aquines, who now had the whole harbour under his guns and at his mercy. Delgadillo agreed to Hawkins's demands. He had no choice. Besides, as a Spanish official on Riohacha had said, when his subordinates reproached him for giving in to Hawkins too easily, "None of you knows John Hawkins. He's a sort of man who, when he talks to you, makes it impossible to deny him what he wants." Inwardly, however, Hawkins was drawing a sigh of relief. He'd made it in. As his other ships took their moorings one by one, he ordered the Spanish vessels and crews he had taken along with him to be released. He even had a letter drafted to send to the Royal Council, or Audiencia, in Mexico City, stating his peaceful intentions and his desire to remain as a guest of Spain with no quarrel between us. The letter never arrived. The Spanish officer dispatched to carry it made instead for Veracruz, to alert the garrison there. Hawkins kept only two Spaniards on board, a friendly, easy-going nobleman named Villanueva and a local official named Bustamante, in order to guarantee a safe stay in San Juan de Ulua. The afternoon passed and night fell on a harbour slowly returning to normal. Normal, that is, except for its uninvited English visitors, Jesus, Minion, Judith, Angel, Swallow, and Grace of God. Hawkins could retire to his cabin and look forward to a day of strenuous hammering and repairs in the morning. So it was with a sense of rude awakening that his lookouts called him out on deck at dawn. Sails had appeared on the horizon, several ships, and large ones, almost certainly armed. Hawkins brought Bustamante up on deck to ask what they could be, but Hawkins had already guessed the answer: the treasure fleet. Hawkins's position was an impossible one. With his guns and ships, he could deny them the harbour, but he would mean a full-scale fight with a Spanish garrison at his back. He couldn't leave without running the same risk. On the other hand, if he allowed them in, he would be at their mercy. The flota would consist of at least some heavily armed galleons, and if they found out who he was, the close confines of his moorings would become a death trap. Robert Barrett turned to ask for orders. "I am between two dangers," Hawkins muttered, "and forced to receive the one of them." By now, Delgadillo had been summoned on board, and he confirmed that it was indeed the treasure fleet. So Hawkins resolved to take the lesser of two evils. He would let the Spanish in, but on his terms. He dispatched Delgadillo in a small boat to tell the Spanish fleet's commander what those terms were. By the time Delgadillo reached the fleet's great flagship, its commander, Admiral Luján, and Viceroy Don Martín Enríquez already knew who was waiting for them in the harbour. Delgadillo had dispatched an earlier boat to them, with news of the Englishman's arrival as soon as he saw sails on the horizon. Now he told them Hawkins's proposal. Hawkins would allow the Spanish fleet into San Juan, but only after they had agreed to allow the English to remain as well. He wanted a signed agreement to that effect, in addition to an official exchange of hostages. The viceroy exploded with rage. He wasn't in the habit of negotiating with pirates and renegades who violated Spanish territory. "Tell him I have 1,000 men with me," Enriquez told Delgadillo. "I am the viceroy of the King of Spain, and I will come into the harbour any time I like." Delgadillo made his way back and could see that the entire island of San Juan, including its shore batteries, had been taken over by the English in preparation for battle. As he swung on board the Jesus, gunpowder and shot were being shifted below and sawdust strewn on deck, with Hawkins himself helping out. The Spaniard remarked on this. No Spanish officer would allow himself to be seen doing manual labour. Delgadillo saluted and conveyed the viceroy's message. Hawkins paused and straightened. "I represent my queen's person," he said with a gruff laugh, "and am a viceroy, literally in place of the king, as well as he. And if he have 1,000 men, my powder and shot will take the better place." Wearily, Delgadillo sailed the 9 miles back to the convoy, which had been joined by all its ships, 13 in all. Enriquez wanted to attack at once, but Admiral Luján, an experienced sailor, explained the situation. The Spanish were in as tight a situation as the English. Hawkins now controlled the entrance to the harbour. An attack would mean being exposed to fire from the shore as well as from Hawkins's guns. The flota was running low on food and water. There was no other safe place to land anywhere on the coast, not even Veracruz. Enriquez would have to swallow his pride and negotiate with that devil, Aquines. The wrangling over terms and hostages took all night and most of the following morning, with Delgadillo ferrying messages back and forth. Then finally, On Saturday, the 18th of September, Hawkins sent 10 of his officers and men with Delgadillo to act as witnesses for the signing of the agreement and to remain as hostages. The document they signed spelled out the division of the harbour between the two fleets, with sworn pledges before God, promising that, on pain of death, no occasion should be given whereby any quarrel should grow to the breach of the agreement. The Spanish officer returned to San Juan with the 10 Spanish hostages for Hawkins and a copy of the document. The deal was done. The Spanish could raise anchor and come into the harbour. But Don Martin Enriquez wasn't yet ready to leave. He was planning a little surprise for John Hawkins. While Delgadillo's small vessel made its way south back to San Juan, the viceroy's attention shifted northward toward Veracruz. The day before, he had dispatched a boat there, ordering every man capable of bearing arms to join the fleet. That night, they began to arrive. Soldiers with breastplates, helmets, pikes, and muskets, squeezing into the lower decks alongside Enriquez's other troops. Enriquez had taken on almost 200 additional men out of sight of any English lookouts before the weather began making it impossible for anyone to come safely alongside. In fact, the weather turned bad for 2 full days, delaying the Spanish entry into San Juan de Ulua until the 21st. Then the flota rode the morning tide into the harbour, sliding past the English manned batteries and past the Jesus and Minion, which discreetly left their gun ports open, even as the ships formally saluted each other, as the manner of the sea doth require, as one eyewitness remembered. The work of getting everyone into their moorings and anchorages was complicated and took all day Tuesday and most of Wednesday. By the time they were done, there were almost 30 vessels moored along a few hundred yards of harbour. Hawkins had made it a condition that all the English ships be moored together. The Minion marked the line of separation between the two fleets, although it was so close to the nearest Spanish vessel that their bowsprits overlapped. The Jesus berthed next to her. Grace of God, Drake's Judith, the Angel and the Swallow all lay on the seaward side. At the other end, the Spanish ships were jammed so tightly together that sailors could walk from one deck onto the next, right up to the old empty hulk that lay alongside the Minion. It was a tight situation in more ways than one, but Hawkins and his men were determined to make the best of it. English and Spanish sailors met warily on the beach and began to exchange greetings and goods. Sailors are sailors, after all, whatever country they come from, and since none wore uniforms, any more than officers did in the Elizabethan Navy, with their beards and ragged patched clothing, there was little to distinguish one from the other, except that the English sailors, by Hawkins's orders, all went ashore with a dagger or sword. On board ship 2, everything gave the appearance of normality. All weapons were again stowed below. Hawkins exchanged formal salutations with his Spanish counterparts. Luján and his vice-admiral, Ubilla, sent parties ashore to collect rope, timber and nails, again armed parties, and set to work to repair his ships. Only a very close Spanish observer might have noticed the axe that stood at the warp heads in the bows of every English vessel, ready to cut the mooring cable at a moment's notice. All was quiet when Hawkins went to bed that night, although he must have felt uneasy. The Spanish had been almost too friendly, too ready and willing to give him the supplies he needed, too acquiescent in these novel arrangements, too obliging indeed for proud men outmaneuvered by foreign intruders. Then, as he lay in his cabin, he heard a noise. Any captain on his ship senses when something is wrong or out of place, and Hawkins sensed that now. He sat up, just as one of his men knocked on the cabin door. There were strange sounds, the man said, coming from the old Spanish hulk. Hawkins went up onto the moonlight-drenched deck and listened. There was no mistaking it. Someone was secretly moving men on board the hulk. Judging from the sound, they were armored men. The Spanish plan was suddenly clear. They were going to use the abandoned hulk as a Trojan horse, filling it secretly with soldiers so that they could storm across to the Minion and the Jesus without warning. It was a trap. But the trap Hawkins had been waiting for. Now he knew the Viceroy had had no intention of keeping his bargain. Now he had time to prepare for them. Hampton, on board the Minion, was aware of what was happening as well. Hawkins whispered to his men to double the watch, but otherwise do nothing. Then he went back to bed, his mind at ease. He would deal with the Spanish and whatever it was they were planning in the morning. As dawn came up on September the 22nd, there was still no sign of trouble. No Spanish soldiers or sailors were anywhere on the beach. Their ships lay still and motionless at their moorings. Hawkins checked the hulk. No sign of life. Still, he dispatched a man to warn Hampton and his crew to expect trouble, and told the steward to prepare an early dinner for 8:30, instead of when an Elizabethan sailor usually dined, at 10. When battle came, at least he would have a full meal under his belt. As the morning wore on, with no move from the Spanish, Hawkins decided to break the tension. He dispatched Barrett to see the Viceroy and ask him whether there were armed soldiers on board the abandoned hulk, in violation of the spirit of their agreement. Meanwhile, he got more disquieting news from his soldiers manning the guns on the island. They had seen carpenters cutting out extra gun ports on the decks of some of the Spanish vessels. Barrett returned to report that Viceroy Enriquez denied that anything was happening on the hulk. Hawkins knew he was being lied to, as well as being lulled into a trap. In his mind, any agreement was now a dead letter. His steward announced that dinner was ready. Before he went below, Hawkins sent Barrett back one last time to ask point blank, were there soldiers on board the hulk or not? As he sat down at table with his remaining officers, his Spanish guest, Señor Villanueva, was all smiles and laughter. But as the steward, John Chamberlain, was about to put down a plate, he saw, out of the corner of his eye, Villanueva move toward Hawkins with something metal in his hand. Quick as thought, Chamberlain pinned Villanueva's arms behind his chair. The something clattered to the floor from Villanueva's hand. It was a dagger. Villanueva blustered and denied everything as Hawkins sprang to his feet. He told his officers to bind the Spaniard hand and foot and keep him in his cabin. Then Hawkins grabbed a loaded crossbow from the wall and dashed up on deck. There he had a clear view of the hulk, which was less than 20 yards away. A figure materialized on its deck. It was Vice Admiral Ubilla, with whom Hawkins had exchanged formal courtesies just yesterday, except now Ubilla was in full armor, with a small white flag in his hand and other armed soldiers behind him. Hawkins called out, "Was this Spanish treachery?" Ubilla replied that he was only doing his duty as an officer and gentleman, just as he knew Hawkins would do his. "You're quite right," Hawkins roared, and aimed his crossbow and fired. His shot missed, but one of his crewmen also let loose a dart, and the soldier next to Ubilla fell. Before he retreated for cover, Ubilla raised his arm and wildly waved his white flag. At that moment, a trumpet sounded on board the Almirante, a loud, clear note that shattered the silence of San Juan Harbor. All at once, Spanish soldiers began to pour out of their ships and swarmed across the shingle bank. The English shore parties guarding the gun batteries were overwhelmed at once. The sailors on the Minion found themselves fighting off a tidal wave of boarders from the adjoining hulk. A short jump across and the Spaniards were on the English deck, flailing and slashing with their swords. The scene was pandemonium. Hawkins watched the battle from the Jesus' towering forecastle as missiles and arrows shot past his head. He shouted to his men, "God and St. George, upon those traitorous villains and rescue the minion." They immediately swung down onto the minion's beleaguered deck and pushed the Spanish back onto the hulk or into the water. But now Spaniards were scrambling onto the Jesus as well, as the hand-to-hand battle raged on both ships. Even as the fight was growing hotter, English sailors were at the bowlines, cutting the cables to cast off. The Judith, the closest to the sea, was the first out. Drake ordered his men aloft to raise sail and get underway, but the other ships were too close to shore to get any breeze to carry them out. Instead, they would have to warp out of harbour. The term warp out conjures up the image of a lightning-quick getaway. In fact, there is probably no slower or more laborious way for a ship to go. It means sending out a kedge anchor in a boat ahead or astern of the ship and lowering it into the water to catch the bottom. Then crewmen man the capstan or anchor spool and haul in the cable until the ship is over the anchor. Then the anchor has to be pulled loose and raised, rowed out again to the end of its cable, lowered in the water, and the whole tedious process begins again. It's a technique of last resort when a captain finds himself stuck fast on a sandbar or with no wind, or, as in the case of San Juan de Ulua, in a sheltered mooring that prevents any breeze from lifting his sails until he's almost out of harbour. Warping is slow and back-breaking work in normal conditions. Under battle conditions, it seems unimaginable. But that was what the English now had to do if they were to get out of danger and bring their guns to bear. For the truth was, even as the Spanish boarders were still fighting desperately, and the crews of the Jesus, Minion, and the rest were straining at their capstans to get themselves out of their moorings, the mistake the Viceroy had made was becoming clear. He had envisioned the surprise attack on Hawkins as a land battle. He had equipped his soldiers with the same weapons they would use in a normal infantry clash, and employed his sailors as boarders. But Hawkins was prepared to fight a battle at sea. His ship's guns might fire slowly. Each gun's crew took 5 minutes to get off a single shot. Gun crews on Nelson's ships at Trafalgar could manage 2 shots every 3 minutes. But at this close range, they wouldn't miss. At first, things were too densely packed for anyone to fire. But as the Minion began to move with a backward lurch, the hulk drifted into her empty berth, exposing the deck and gunwales of the flagship Almirante. When the Minion's gun crews looked through their gun ports, they could suddenly see a target. Almost at once, all the guns on her port side roared out, sending hot metal into the Almirante's side. Then, as the English ships pulled apart, the Jesus joined in, with spectacular results. A shot from one of its great culverins ignited a gunpowder barrel on the Almirante. With a tremendous blast, the entire starboard side of the ship blew apart, engulfing the ship in flames and black smoke. As the stricken Almirante began to capsize, it was Capitana's turn. Shots ripped into her hull as timbers cracked and gave way. Since her sailors were with the boarding parties, there was no one to answer the English fire. The Viceroy himself had to hide behind the mainmast as deadly splinters flew in all directions, killing and maiming the men around him. Exultant, Hawkins surveyed the scene. 3 of his men, including a youngster named Job Hartop, had swum out from the shingle to be picked up by the Jesus. They were all that was left of his shore parties. There was no sign of Barrett. But in spite of the confusion, it looked like the English ships were almost free. Judith was already out of the harbour, and the Grace of God and Angel were following. Only the Swallow seemed still stuck in her mooring. Meanwhile, the Jesus and Minion had driven off their last attackers. Off his port beam, the Capitana was slowly sinking, while the Almirante was ablaze from end to end. The English ships really did seem free. They had managed to pull themselves 2 cable lengths, or almost 400 yards, from the nearest Spanish ships, when suddenly the bombardment from the shore started. The Jesus was still not far enough out to use her sails. With his men still laboriously warping the vessel along, Hawkins had to bear the brunt of it. The Jesus's high castles presented perfect targets for the Spanish gun crews, while her slow, ungainly form struggled to manoeuvre. Although the old ship could reply shot for shot, and could act as shield for the smaller minion, it was a battle the Jesus couldn't sustain for long. By now, it was late afternoon. As the gun duel with the shore commenced, Hawkins called his mulatto page, Samuel, to bring him something to drink. The boy brought back beer in a silver cup, which Hawkins drank to the bottom. He had just set it down to give an order when a Spanish shot swept it away. Hawkins called out to his men, "Fear nothing! God, who hath preserved us from this shot, will also deliver us from these traitors and villains." The English redoubled their fire at the island. Then a shot aimed high to cut the rigging severed the foremast just below its upper supports, and it came crashing down on deck. Hawkins ordered the St. George banner to be tied to the stump that remained. He looked back into the harbour, where smoke from the Almirante continued to drift across the scene. The shore batteries were now firing on his other ships as well. The Angel was stricken and sinking, as was Swallow. The Grace of God had tried to escape heading out the opposite way in the North Channel, but took a terrible pounding as it ran past the Spanish ships still in their moorings. Finally, its French captain had to set it alight and abandon ship, swimming out to be picked up by Hawkins and the Jesus. He explained that he had hoped to draw off the Spanish fire and torched his ship in the hope that it might ignite the rigging of the nearby Spanish galleons, but failed. "If you had done so," Hawkins roared over the din, clapping him on the back, "you had done well." A horrendous noise interrupted him. A shot had ploughed into the mainmast, which, weakened by the earlier weeks of storms, now came crashing down on deck, killing 12 men, and slid overboard, dragging sails, braces, and bodies with it. The Jesus was now almost dead in the water as her firing slackened. Hawkins signalled the minion to come alongside. Sheltered in the shadow of the Jesus's great bulk, the minion was safe for the moment. Hawkins gave orders to Hampton. Everything and everyone from the Jesus was transferring to the minion, and everything that she couldn't carry would go into the Judith. Even now, Hawkins was signalling Drake to come alongside as well, since they were still in range of the shore guns. There was no time to lose. Once the Judith was laid up beside the minion, work went quickly. Teams of men moved provisions, tools, and ammunition out of the battered Jesus and into the minion. Hawkins supervised the transfer of goods on board as well, including his gold and silver, most of which passed on to Drake and the Judith. However, one great trunk stuffed with silver ingots was too heavy to move out of its deep hold, and, to Hawkins's rage, had to be abandoned. Last of all came the wounded. Men shot by arrows, pierced by sword or pike, maimed by musket or cannonball, or horribly gashed by flying splinters, were carried up on deck to be loaded onto the minion. Then suddenly a cry came up, "Fire ships!" Hawkins turned. Out of the late afternoon gloom came a monstrous sight. An empty Spanish galleon, flames engulfing her masts and deck, was bearing directly down on the 3 English vessels. It was the Spaniard's last ploy, a kamikaze mission to immolate Hawkins with every sailor's worst nightmare, a fire at sea. Now it was his crew's turn to panic. With shouts of "Make off!" Men began scrambling to escape, dropping wounded comrades overboard and leaping for the Minion. Job Hartop watched as two men jumped and missed, plunging into the water to be crushed between the two hulls. Francis Drake didn't hesitate. He cut the lashings that bound him to the Minion and Jesus and moved out of harm's way. Hawkins couldn't control his men, even though he shouted to them that the unmanned fireship, which was already drifting off course, was less of a threat than the guns on shore. Finally, he ordered everyone to abandon ship and join the scramble onto the Minion. He was the last man off the Jesus. In those days, no captain in his right mind went down with his ship, or thought he was, when he turned back to see his 11-year-old nephew, Paul Horswell, still on deck with another sailor. In the boy's hand were a crystal plate and goblet which he had tried to rescue from his uncle's cabin at the last minute. Everyone now turned to the boy as a Minion began to move away. "Jump! Jump!" they shouted. Young Horswell was about to obey when a stray shot suddenly struck the man next to him, who fell overboard. Shaken, the boy threw the goblet and plate into the sea and silently watched as the Minion sailed out of range. He would never see his uncle or England again. Whatever Hawkins's feelings at that moment, he and his men had to move quickly. Shot was still falling fast around his new flagship, the Minion, as he signaled Drake and the Judith to join him out of range. As they sailed into the gathering dusk, the sound of gunshots died away, while the burning fireship lit up the western sky behind them. No other Spaniards followed them. They had clearly had enough of battle with Hawkins. And so, finally out of sight of San Juan de Ulua, Hawkins and Drake were able to drop anchor in the dark and assess their losses. Hawkins had begun the day with 6 ships. He now had 2. Of his 300 men, he had lost more than a third. It was true that he had given nearly as well as he had gotten, and sent the Spaniards' 2 proud flagships to the bottom. He had escaped the trap they had elaborately set for him, including the fireship, but escape had cost him dearly, in blood, ships, and, thinking of the silver he had been forced to abandon on the Jesus, treasure. Yet no grief at his losses could equal the rage he felt at having been deceived and betrayed. The Spaniards had given their word, and then played him false. Somehow, some way, he would make them pay. In the morning, he had one more nasty shock. The Judith was gone. A few hours before dawn, Drake had raised anchor and set sail, taking with him the bulk of the gold and silver his cousin had transferred to him, and leaving Hawkins and his overloaded, undersupplied ship to their fate. A heartless and selfish move, no doubt, but also a clear-eyed one. The Judith, escorting the wounded and clumsy Minion, might make it home to England. The Judith alone almost certainly would. Here, in 1568, on his first command, Francis Drake revealed himself as he would be for the rest of his career, a smart, bold, ruthless bastard. Hawkins may have cursed Drake's name and his own bad luck, but he also knew that whatever had befallen him and his men up to this point, worse was almost certainly going to come. No coastline, port, or island in the Caribbean was now safe. The Minion would have to sail directly for Europe without stopping for supplies, even though she was woefully short of food and water. When they learned this, almost half his crew, including Job Hartop, told him they wanted to be left behind on the coast to take their chances with the Spanish or the natives, rather than live on boiled leather on the voyage home. Hawkins didn't mind. It lessened the number of men he would have to feed, and contemplating the coming trip, he could hardly blame them. The Atlantic crossing took 3 months. Hawkins had to deal with starvation, storms, and mutiny. His men ate every living thing they could find on the ship, pigs, dogs, rats, and parrots, until they got down to chewing on pieces of oxhide and leather gloves. Halfway through, the dread of every long-distance ocean voyager struck. Scurvy. Men's gums bled, their teeth fell out, and their legs and fingers turned black. Finally, the Minion made landfall in northwest Spain. Hawkins entered the port of Vigo to beg for food before all his men died. A Spanish eyewitness caught sight of him there, gaunt and haggard, but with the same crimson velvet breeches and a scarlet leather jacket trimmed with silver braid, and the same air of self-assured command. The Minion left Vigo on January the 20th, 1569, and reached Plymouth Sound on January the 25th. Of the 100 men he sailed from America with, there were 15 survivors. When he came ashore, he learned that Drake and the Judith had arrived in Plymouth 3 days earlier. But Hawkins was too preoccupied for recriminations. For one thing, there was still business to be done. Even after all that they had been through, Hawkins was able to send to his partners in London more than 25,000 golden pesos on 4 pack horses. As for what he had lost at San Juan, he and his syndicate filed a lawsuit with the Court of Admiralty with a claim for £28,000 in damages, including the cost of the Jesus and its guns, arms, equipment, and Hawkins' shipboard wardrobe. Then he tried to find out what happened to his men who were still in Spanish hands. News was hard and slow to come by, but what did trickle in for the next couple of years wasn't good. Most of those taken at San Juan de Ulua had been killed out of hand. The few survivors, like Robert Barrett, were held for trial in Spain. The men Hawkins had left behind on the Mexican coast fared no better. They had originally split into 2 groups. The smaller group headed north, and although they managed to evade the Spanish, only 3 of the 23 ever found their way back to England. The larger group had headed south for Tampico. They were quickly caught and forced on a death march to Mexico City without food or water, on which many died. When the survivors reached the capital, Don Martin Enriquez wanted to hang them all, but was persuaded to wait for a proper investigation. Some were sent to be tried in Spain. The rest had to wait until 1571, when a special board of the Mexican Inquisition convened to consider their cases, not as pirates, but as Protestant heretics. The Inquisition tried 30 men. 11 had been 16 or younger in 1568, which shows how young sailors were in Hawkins' day, and were given relatively light sentences. Miles Phillips, who was just 14 when he sailed with Hawkins, went to prison for 3 years. Hawkins' nephew, Paul Horswell, who had chosen to remain on the Jesus rather than jump, was given a flogging and even less prison time. Eventually, Horswell was released, converted to Catholicism, and married a half-caste Mexican woman. His descendants were still living in Mexico a century later. The remaining 19 weren't so lucky. Almost all received a back-breaking flogging and then were condemned to serve in the floating prisons of His Catholic Majesty's galleys. William Griffin of Bristol was sentenced to 200 lashes and 8 years in the galleys. John Williams of Cornwall and Robert Plinton of Plymouth the same. Thomas Goodall of London got 300 lashes and 10 years. The Mexican Inquisition decided George Ribsey of Gravesend wasn't sufficiently repentant of his Protestant views and that he should be burned at the stake, although it graciously allowed him to be strangled before being put to the fire. Of the rest, only Miles Phillips would live to return to England. As for the prisoners shipped to Spain, most died in captivity. One, George Fitzwilliam, managed to escape and get a letter to John Hawkins to give him some idea of what was happening to his former men. Robert Barrett and Job Hartop were put on a ship for Havana in 1571, with a final destination in Spain. As they entered the Florida Channel late that night, Barrett noticed that they were sailing too close to the point of land known as Cape Canaveral. Barrett noticed that they were sailing too close to the point of land known as Cape Canaveral, and shouted in Spanish to the crew to open sail and to the helmsman to bear away. Barrett had saved the Spanish ship and crew, as the captain profusely admitted. The Spanish repaid him by shipping him across the Atlantic to prison at Terceira in the Azores, where he tried to escape but failed. Barrett arrived in Seville in chains and was incarcerated in the Casa de Contratación, the headquarters of Spain's New World trade monopoly, which Hawkins had tried to break in vain. Inquisitors condemned Barrett's fellow prisoner Job Hartop to 10 years in the galleys, and then life imprisonment in an inquisitorial prison. Barrett and another Englishman, John Gilbert, were burned at the stake, this time without the mercy of being strangled first. Hartop would end up serving 12 years as a rower in the Spanish galleys, the equivalent of a death sentence for most men, including every one of his fellow English prisoners. Hartop, however, survived, although hunger, thirst, and stripes we lacked none, he wrote later, till our several times expired. In 1585, Hartop came back to Seville to turn in his rower's loincloth for a penitent's robes and to begin his life sentence. For the next 4 years, Hartop languished in a Spanish prison. In the meantime, John Hawkins redesigned the English navy, drawing on his own experience at San Juan de Ulua. Francis Drake captured Cartagena and destroyed the Spanish fleet at Cadiz. Queen Elizabeth ordered the beheading of Mary, Queen of Scots. The Armada sailed and was beaten in the English Channel. Sir Walter Raleigh set up his ill-fated colony in America, and Hawkins and Martin Frobisher began a series of regular English patrols off the Azores, in hopes of capturing the Spanish treasure fleet. Then, in 1590, the Inquisition allowed Hartop to begin a prison work release program as a servant for a merchant family in Seville. One day in October, he saw his chance and escaped. He made it to the port of Sanlúcar, where he caught a ride on a Flemish coastal vessel. Off Cape St. Vincent, the southwestern tip of Spain, they were intercepted by the Dudley, one of the new English warships on its way to patrol the Azores. Hartop was free at last. He finally returned to England on December the 2nd, 1590. It was just a little more than 23 years since he had left home.